Hello and welcome to Mega City Book Club, the podcast all about the galaxy's greatest comics, mostly the British ones. I'm Eamon Clarke. It's day two at Lawless in Bristol, and I'm in my hotel room recording with Richard Chief. Good morning, Richard.
Good morning, Eamon. Lovely to be here. Thank you for the invite.
Thank you for coming back again and doing it, our regular slot. This is number eight we've worked out, isn't it?
This is, yeah. Due to popular indifference, I'm back again. So
competing now for the top slot with Tony Esmond and Conrad.
This is, yeah, top three territory. This is bronze medal all the way at the moment.
Pete Wells, watch out. Now, we have got an awful lot to talk about. You, of course, are my go-to correspondent for the sort of classic 20th century British comic book artists and cartoonists. And you haven't disappointed this time because you've chosen another interesting one. Tell us the book that we're talking about today.
So the book we're talking about today is called The Fantastic Art of Ron Turner. That's fantastic as in fantastical and fantastic as in amazing. So aptly titled, Vertha. Yes, as your 1950s space correspondent, I am back.
Right. So this is by John Lawrence. It's from Telos Publishing Limited in 2025. So it's just last year. Edited by Stephen James Walker. Hefty hardback with a long list of thank yous, including to the recently departed Barry Tomlinson. Very sad.
Yes.
Nice guy. Giant of British comics publishing. Always very eager to engage with the fans. Mm. You know, enjoyed the fan experience, didn't he?
Yes. Yes. He got the best out of Twitter. Let's put it like that.
So, yes. Yeah. Aged 88. Tiger, Roy the Rover's Speed, New Eagle, Scream. Many more. Yeah. Okay, right. So, Ron Turner, why did you want to choose this book to talk about?
I thought it's a new book. Yeah. Feels like it weighs about 3 kilos. You know, you could definitely kill somebody with this book if you weren't careful. I chose it. I mean, he died nearly 30 years ago, 1998. So, you know, we always worry that, you know, artists that one generation has loved, you know, one generation later can begin to fade from view a little. So always happy to shine the spotlight in that case. I think he produced so much work that whatever you know, by the time you finish this book, you'll realize, more importantly, how much you don't know and how much, you know, you say, I had no idea he worked on that. Some of his artwork, you know, we'll touch on, I'm sure, is iconic, is Marvel UK work they did for Doctor and the Daleks. It was reprinted a few years ago, sold like hotcakes at the time. I remember it was very hard to get hold of a copy, and yeah, that's really where he's remembered. But yeah, just great to bring back this artist.
So before I get you to spotlight Ron Turner and tell us a bit about his life and work, the format and layout of the book, just tell us, as you say, it's a big hardback. Mm. What does this book do, as it were, in terms of telling the story?
I mean, it's a very detailed chronological view of Turner's life. We've had a number of comic writers produce their autobiographies in recent years. Brian Bolland's approach in his story is quite different from Dave Gibbons, say, in Confabulation, where Dave tells us stories throughout his life, but not in a sort of 1, 2, 3, 4 order. Whereas this is a very detailed linear look at Turner's life. Starting sort of in the pre-war period, the sort of late 1930s, all the way up to his death in 1998. But there's sort of definitely two stages, two distinct phases of his life. So his working life with his agent, his mysterious agent, Mr. Hall, Greg Hall, and then there's sort of this post-Greg Hall life towards the last 15 years of his life, where he acquires a new agent and the world changes for him. You know, in some ways for the better, in some ways for the worse, but... And the book, I mean, the production standard sold absolutely the highest quality, you know, lovely, thick, glossy paper, black and color illustrations, absolutely throughout, appreciations from friends, families, people who knew him. The bibliography at the back is 20 pages long, incredibly detailed year by year what he was producing. So, you know, if you wanted to work out your Ron Turner checklist of, you know, how I got, you know, that would be the place to start. And then, incredibly, the bibliography shows that His work is still being published up in Donnersburg. Bibliography runs until 2025, when the book was published, and there's still material that features Ron's work. So even though he died 30 years ago, there are still people out there publishing work with his artwork in it.
We might touch on that later on, because it seems like, in a way, a great shame that he's getting all this recognition after he's gone, in a way. But it is a beautifully produced book, as you say. The reproduction of the artwork in full colour glossy is great. Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
And it's brilliant. It's copious as well, isn't it? There's lots of artwork in this book.
Yeah. Like I say, if you think, you know, you recognise, you know, you had a sort of a 5 or 10 or 15 year period where you were reading things and you recognise that bit, and there's like, well, hang on, there's another 300 pages of this is what he did before, this is what he did afterwards. But yeah, just a very large reproduction as well. You know, some books you can get, you know, you get, there's all the art, but it, you know, it can be quite small, whereas this, the art really sings in this book. You know, lots of full, you know, full cover, full page for one image, for one paperback cover that he's done. So it's,
yes,
very indulgent.
Okay, so Ron Turner himself, give us a potted history of his life and his work.
So he's born in 1922, dies in 1998. So his sort of career spans that sort of the whole sort of publishing, you know, sort of maybe the peak years, it feels, of British sort of comics publishing. But he doesn't start in comics, or he starts in Modern Wonder just before the pre-war, and Kinematograph. I'm not even sure if that's how you pronounce it. Cinematograph Weekly. How he spelled it with a K. Post-war, he then moves on to what kind of early sort of paperback covers, sort of the pulp paperbacks that were produced after the war, and starts on some early strip cartooning. And then, you know, by the mid-50s, he's sort of the king of the paperback covers, producing an array of titles. Then moves more into comics and the Rick Random story that people may have come across. Some of it was reprinted in early 2000 AD. Annuals and specials. I know Conrad has touched on it in the, you know, there's a special circle of hell that is reserved for Rick Random. But I think that's in the storytelling, not in the art, you know, in Conrad's defense. So he's working on the pulp titles. Then moves more into the mainstream. Ends up drawing by the early 60s. He's working on picture libraries. Then he tries out for Buster, some covers for Practical Mechanics, which again, often you see in sort of secondhand bookshops or 50s, 60s. You know, there's amazing sort of space themed covers, that sort of, what do you call it, sort of techno utopianism.
Yes, very much. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, that sort of that positive can do 50s post war. Exemplified by those Practical Mechanics covers. He swerves for sort of 5 years away from all of this into drawing. And this, it sounds like I'm doing him down by saying painting by numbers kits,
right?
Which sounds extremely uninteresting. But there are, again, the book is full of reproductions of his work on these kits, which would be amongst, I'm sure, the rarest of the Ron Turner material you could even try and collect. But eventually, he works his way back into comics. In the late 1960s, he works on the Daleks strip and Thunderbirds, and probably reaches his sort of zenith of his colour painting on those strips. By the early 1970s, he's into working for the sort of the Fleetway comics that Fleetway IBC were producing, lots of work in annual specials across a range of titles that humour comics that, you know, if you pick up a 70s annual, there's probably something by Ron Turner in it, if Leroy produced it. Then he tries to come into sort of the 2000 AD battle action space towards the end of the 1970s, less successfully, I think it's fair to say, than the work he did on the humor strips. But it's certainly in the book, you can feel as the time moves on, sort of the publishing industry is contracting around him. And again, this sort of, his agent, he has Greg Hall, who's extremely controlling individual, wouldn't let anybody contact Turner in any way, shape or form. And they have a particularly, is it a healthy relationship? Is it a toxic relationship? I'm not sure, but Turner's options are narrowing as the book goes on. And there are fewer and fewer people to fall out with, but they still seem to be falling out with them at approximately the same rate. And it's only towards the mid-80s when Hall is sadly incapacitated through a stroke and has to retire. And Turner suddenly thinks, oh my God, I'm not quite pensionable age yet. You know, can I sort of make it from 62 to 65 before I get my pension? Can I just sort of get there? And at this point, his sort of artistic life is turned around by meeting John Lawrence, who finally tracks him down, like Stanley meeting Livingston in the in Africa in the 19th century. And then sort of the final 15 years of his career are working with John Lawrence on some small press comics, but also spending a lot of time on these beautiful recreations of his 50s pulp covers. So I think artistically extremely fulfilling, although in his personal life, he's moving into more and more reduced circumstances, but happy in his art. It's a, you know, it's quite a sort of bittersweet ending to it all. Actually, you know, he was so much about the art, and that was what he wanted to create more than anything else. So it's a real sort of love letter to Turner. Beautifully done.
So I'm going to ask you about John Lawrence in a moment. We'll get to talk about Ron Turner's art. I like what you said, that the idea that you can see the publishing world or the publishing business constricting around Turner. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Things get tighter as, you know, for everybody as time goes on. Also, the Paint by Numbers was huge. You know, it was a huge sort of popularity at the time. And you and I have talked in the past about artists having to take whatever gig's going, really, isn't it? You know, you've got to make money from it.
Yeah.
And Paint by Numbers, I remember that was a massive thing.
Yeah.
I'm not too surprised that he did that as well, because I imagine it must have paid at least.
Yes. Well, yeah. And like I say, I mean, there are plenty of examples in the book. I mean, I think you would have to, they're not distinctively Ron Turner-esque. They are not of spaceships. They're not of Daleks. They are, you know, they're not of that sort of future techno utopianism. You know, they are much more straightforward as a sort of, here is a jungle scene. Here is a riverside scene. Here is a, you know, and then, you know, it was much more just, no, we just need someone to draw up. And this goes into detail and a couple of bits of the book about actually how complicated they are to, you know, create artistically. But he does it very successfully for 5 or 6 years. And then even later on in his life, when he does a lot of work on the Thunderbirds sort of specials and annuals. But he also produced a number of Painting by Numbers kits for them. So it's something he goes back to later in life.
I'll just very quickly mention, I also remember that he was in World War II. He was wounded at Monte Cassino and still served afterwards in the Far East, even after recovering from his wound. And Monte Cassino was not a very nice place to be if you were a soldier on either side.
Not for the faint of heart.
Yes, not for faint of heart. So astonishing. Okay, his artwork. He'll be familiar to 2000 AD readers for Robot Wars, which we've done with Lee on the podcast. I love the techno-utopianism sort of description. How would you describe Ron Turner's artwork? Classic Ron Turner.
I mean, in classic Ron Turner, as far as 2000 AD, that sort of that early Robot Wars strip, which is in sort of really not quite the single number progs, is it? But it's very early, sort of the first mega epic. Okay, it's black and white. It's quite sort of use of negative space. It's quite simplistic is not the word, but it looks, I think, deceptively simple and straightforward. But that is in such contrast to the amazing color artwork that he produced earlier in his career, when he was doing the colors for Practical Mechanics, when he was working on the Daleks strip, where the color is just absolutely, it's just luminescent. It just absolutely sings off the page. And I mean, this book, I think you can safely say I could recommend this to anyone, this book. Not if you're into Warhammer and that sort of, is it grim dark? I think they call it the sort of that particular style, that particular, you know, this is not, this is, you know, if grim dark is at one end of the spectrum, Ron Turner is at the other end of the spectrum, you know, it's positive, it's uplifting, and the colour is just extraordinary. So it deserves its place in comics history.
Does that very curved snake-necked robot in Robot Wars, which seems to me sort of like, you know, typical of Ron Turner's art, these beautiful curves. But as you say, it's the colour work that's fantastic. And I know we've discussed this already in the car, but I wondered if it was that techno-utopianism was popular in the 1950s, particularly because of the sort of austerity of post-rationing times. You know, everything's quite grim and bleak. And maybe you need those paperback covers and you need those magazine covers that look like science is going to make a better world.
There is literally a brighter future
ahead. Yes.
Ahead. And yeah, those Practical Mechanics covers, you know, are definitely in that. You know, they're sort of, you know, they are, you know, it's a magazine designed to help you do things, but it also has this almost sort of sci-fi cover on the front, though. You know, it is not the sort of thing you'd be practically doing at home in your DIY, but it is that vision of the future. And then, like I say, the sort of the buildings, the shapes, the rockets, they're all, you know, there's very round edges to everything. So, you know, not sort of hard, everything is sort of not soft and gentle, but you know, has that sinuous quality to it, in a lot of his work that's fantastic to look at.
Beautiful colors, beautiful rounded edges, as you say, very optimistic, very hopeful. As I say, 2000 AD readers familiar with Robot Wars, perhaps we should be familiar with his Daleks work. And again, in the 1960s, even in the late 1960s, I think most people who watched the Daleks were watching, well, in fact, all Doctor Who was black and white up until John Pertwee, wasn't it? So you saw the Daleks in black and white. But if you got TV Century 21 comic and turned to the back page, you saw the Daleks in Technicolor, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the only other option was the two Dalek big screen movies. But to see the Daleks and to have this world where they extended the Dalek universe and put the Daleks in conflict with other space races, and to see it all in Ron Turner's beautiful colours, it must have been mind-blowing at the time.
Yeah, and even in TV Century 21, I mean, I think it's Richard Jennings who works on the strip before Turner, and you know, that's in colour. It's very, you know, but Jennings is a very different artist. You know, it's definitely more sort of noodling, but it's slightly darker. It's black and white. The colours just, you know, are not, you know, the story might be the same, that, you know, the Daleks are struggling against these other races, but the art, you know, the colors and the style that Jennings draws, you know, is so different to Turner that, you know, it's just absolutely glows off the page like it's radioactive something. It's got a half-life. So, yeah.
And Doctor Who fans are going to correct me, but I believe certain elements like the Emperor Dalek and the flying platforms that the Daleks sort of travel around on originated in the comic strip as opposed to on the TV show, because obviously there wasn't a budget for that in the TV show.
No.
But if you've got Ron Turner or Richard Jennings before, if you've got Ron Turner, you can put whatever you like on the page in a way.
You can take off. But I think also he's, you know, and again, don't at me, but you know, the number of nodules on a Dalek is, you know, important, and it's important to some people, but I don't think it was important enough to Turner to go, oh, I must just check I've got five nodules, not four nodules. He's like, I've drawn this page and this is the page you are getting, and thank you very much, and whether it's right or wrong, this is, you know, which maybe is ties into his relationship with Mr. Hall.
Yes.
The mysterious Mr. Hall, who features in this book in a way that I've never known an artist's agent. Maybe, you know, Barry Coker, I'm sure, in Dave Gibbons' confabulations, comes out of it very well, and Dave always speaks very highly of Barry, but never in a book have you come across, you know, an agent who was so pivotal to the, you know, the success of an artist, and how protected Turner was,
yes,
by Hall. You know, all the people, you know, we mentioned Barry Tomlinson earlier, you know, people like him was, you know, they would deal with Hall, the agent who, I think, earlier in his career had been wronged by an artist who effectively jumped ship, and he'd lost his 10%, and he was almost sworn never to lose his 10% ever again. We had Turner, and he was the goose that was laying the golden egg, as it were, and he would not pass on Turner's contact details. He would not let anyone speak to him. And all these, you know, so the Barry Tomlinsons as well were sitting there going, is this all an elaborate ruse? Is Hall Ron Turner? Because nobody can talk to Ron Turner. Who, you know, this guy turns up every week with this art and it's amazing. Thank you very much. But is he really drawing the art? You know, can we afford to fall out with Hall? Because if Hall is Turner and we annoy him, then the art world will go, you know. So I think they're probably in fear of Hall and don't want to fall out with him. And that protects Turner, who, yeah, gets to a stage in his career where he's like, I draw the art, I'm the sci-fi artist, you get what you're given. And his editors, you know, the Aaron Tomlinsons, the Stephen Manises, is like, well, actually, you know, can we just have a bit more of this, a bit more of that? And then Hall won't let them near him. Yeah, to Ron's detriment in the end, because they said, well, if we can't talk about how the art needs to be different, we can't go forward. And
well, as you know, I want to ask you about that. Could that say that, you know, the 50s, the 60s, the early 70s, Ron Turner's heyday.
Yep.
By the late 70s, there is a new wave of comics and a new wave of editors coming along. Steve McManus, Des Skin particularly. Mm. Barry Tomlinson's still there. Dave Hunt gets a mention, I believe. And I got the sense that, yes, at this period, as the publishing world is both constricting, but it's changing.
Mm.
That techno-utopianism is perhaps not quite as popular because people are beginning to realise the future isn't quite so bright and colourful.
And the late 70s, we've pivoted back to a lack of colour and you know, a harder edge, a bit more grim dark.
Steve McManus and Des Skim want a bit more grim dark.
Mm.
They want some slightly grittier artwork to go with this grittier stories that are appearing. And I don't know the answer, but I get the feeling that at this point, either Ron or the mysterious Mr. Halls were saying, no, this is Ron Turner. You know, he is science fiction. You're going to get what you're given.
If you want a sci-fi comic and you want a sci-fi artist, he's the guy. And like you say, he's suddenly, it feels like he's a man out of time, out of step with what the market wants. And because they can't get at him to say it, you know, can you do it a bit more like this rather than like that? That makes it difficult. And I think, you know, John Lawrence talks about, you know, even with small press work that he did in later years, if he said, oh, actually, you know, can we change this? You know, that doesn't quite work. You know, Turner is, no, you know, I've done the page is finished. You know, I want to move on. I'm not going back and reworking that page. You know,
right.
You'll have to sort something out about that. So, you know, again, this is not editor-friendly territory in an environment where you're running out of editors and editors want something different now than they wanted and that he's been producing successfully for 20, 30 years. I think maybe it's one of the reasons why he gets work on the sort of this vast array of specials and holiday specials and annuals, because he can work at his own pace, in his own way. He doesn't have that sort of tyranny of weekly deadline. You know, he's still producing an enormous amount of stuff, but it's just not to those weekly deadlines where like, oh, it's just, you know, can you just change this or change this? It's like, no, it's just being produced with the annuals and the specials. It arrives, it's done, thank you very much.
Yeah. I know from my reading of the book, of course, the mysterious agent falls out with Steve McManus and Des Skin.
Yeah.
I think Dave Hunt, they managed to stay cordial with, and Barry Tomlinson particularly, I think, you know, they, which is perhaps more, says more about Barry Tomlinson, but you know, because again, tribute to the recently deceased Barry, I've not heard anybody say anything bad about him. Yeah. And you know, everybody has good stories about working with him.
Yes.
So yeah, maybe that's Barry more than the agent.
They can come to that accommodation somehow. It's not that he delivers work later, it's that he's promised to do some work and then a better offer comes in. And Hall says, well, you've got to go with the better offer, goes the better offer, which in the long term doesn't really work out at all, and then has to sort of slink back to Des Skin with his sort of tail between his legs and say, oh, can we do that work that we were going to do? And Des is already like, well, I had to give it to somebody else.
I filled those pages. Yeah.
And you've let me down.
Yeah.
And you're never coming back. You know, so he has these sort of black marks that can live against him. It's only, I think certainly within 2000, you know, there has to be a change of editor to sort of go, ah, we burnt our bridges with the last editor, but there's a new one in town. Right. Let's start again. Okay. Let's, you know, actually, we can get work in New Eagle. You know, we can get work in places where a few years previously you may have lost out. So, yeah.
There's that famous aphorism in comic books that we often talk about, the triangle, where you have to be either good or quick or easy to work with. and you have to be at least two of the triangles to succeed. I was trying to think, who was it the other day? There was somebody I was thinking about who I thought is probably all three.
Yeah.
But anyway, just to mention, I mean, John Lawrence, I want to ask you about John Lawrence, what you know about him. John Lawrence, as you say, sort of saves Ron in a way at the end and saves his reputation and gets him more work. Because without going into too much detail, Ron's circumstances towards the end of his life, he was not living in the lap of luxury, was he at all?
No. I mean, I think, well, you know, we're here at Lawless and, you know, there are, you know, a number of artists downstairs and, you know, a lot of them will, you know, love drawing just, you know, as a part of their being. And a lot of them will have to draw, you know, sadly.
Forever.
Forever. You know, I've met a lot of comic artists over the years and very few of them have a solid pension plan that means actually that, you know, they're just doing it for fun. You know, they are, you know, it's not a well-paid gig. Luckily, a lot of them retain their love for it as a craft of the medium. So they continue to do it. But yeah, you know, Turner definitely fits into that category as well through bad luck, circumstance, you know, whatever it is. His life, you know, towards the end, you know, is not good. But his art and the sort of the pleasure he gets from it via John Lawrence, the commissions that he secures for him, either to do small press work or to do artistic recreations, or, you know, which fill the book, are wonderful. And there's no diminution in the quality of the art that Turner is working on. There's no sort of, oh, you start at the, you know, the start of the book and the quality is X, and then, oh, then it goes up, oh, and then sadly it goes down. You know, yeah. No, you know, there is a solid, you know, just because he's, you know, in his later years, it's not that he's taking on simpler work or the color palette is changing and he's getting more. No. It all continues to a very high standard for a very long time.
Yes, the Ron Turner art from the end of the book looks very much like the Ron Turner art from the start of the book in terms of it's as good as, isn't it? It's as good as. He doesn't take shortcuts. Yeah. He always produces wonderful pieces of work, and that may have been part of the trouble with the 70s and 80s editors. I don't know. We you and I love comics, but we also love, or perhaps maybe not love, we're fascinated by the mechanics, the stories. How do these things get produced? Which is still always a bit of a mystery. But reading stuff like this, you think, well, gosh, actually, it's quite hard, isn't it? You know,
he talks about sort of working on, there's a phase where he's working on sort of battle picture library, war picture library, you know, which enjoys, and he brings the knowledge to it, like you said, through his wartime service in Europe and in the Far East. But, you know, but it takes him, you know, a couple of months. This is no slight. I mean, it takes him, you know, a couple of months to draw a whole picture library. So, and he's producing, you know, so he might produce half a dozen, and that's a whole year spent. And you think, but I could read those in a morning.
Mm.
And that, you know, that's a year's work. You know, it's incredible to, you know, when you, you know, work it back to sort of how many frames a day. Okay, well, you've got 64 pages here, you know, four frames, and you do the maths, and, you know, it's a year's work. And, you know, oh, I've read that, you know, right, well, you know, what should I read this afternoon? Or another year's worth of work. So, yeah. It's incredible.
We won't talk about it too much, but I will just mention there's a houseboat. He lives on a houseboat.
Yeah.
Which sort of sinks once, catches fire another time, I think. You know, it's not... It's not the ideal retirement property, is it?
It's not the techno-utopianism of the future.
Certainly not. Yeah, it's a good point. John Lawrence. This book is by John Lawrence. Mm. What do you know about... And as you say, at the end, John Lawrence sort of comes in and builds a relationship with Ron and saves him in a way. What do you know about John Lawrence himself?
Not very much. I mean, I used to... I mean, as well as producing... So there's obviously, you know, an interesting book, 400 pages, all about Ron Turner's work. But before this, as a sort of an hors d'oeuvre, John had been producing magazines that reprinted, and in some mainly Space Ace work that Ron had worked on in the 50s. And he produced a run of about a dozen, 15 of those. And sometimes they were just straight reprints. Sometimes he merged strips together. But that was part of his work to keep Turner in the public eye, as it were, even though, you know, Turner died in the late 90s. So he was producing these, and, you know, he would always email me and say, oh, you know, got a new, there's a new issue out, you know, it's £8 or something. You know, it was all, and I know Steve Holland on Bear Alley, you know, would always championing them, John, bringing them on down the tubes. And, you know, Steve was always very, this, you know, this is being produced at cost, people. This, there's no margin in this. This is just somebody who is producing this and is slightly surprised to find that that first issue of 100 copies sold very well. So, okay, let's do another one and another one. But, yeah, so that, you know, that was a great way of, you know, keeping Ron's work alive in the sort of probably the 2010s and late early 2020s. But I never met him. And like I say, he would correspond. So, oh, yeah, it's a new show out if you're interested. And I was always like, obviously I'm interested. Obviously I paid you the money. Please send it. It was a lovely magazine, Space Ace magazine.
The book's obviously a great tribute to Ron Turner, but it's also, this book is a tribute to John Lawrence himself. Because Lawrence,
yes,
sadly passes away before it actually is published.
It's very, very sad. This sort of life's work, and you know, this is an unbelievable collection of if not all of Turner's work, you know, within 99.99% of his work. And yeah, it's sort of to write it and to, you know, to have your life's work and then not live to see it published is
heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking, really. Yeah. It's the universe playing a cruel trick on you. So he doesn't finish it. So actually, Phil Harbottle, who's another 1950s sci-fi enthusiast, he runs a sort of a video series on YouTube. Again, if you go to Down the Tube's website, John Freeman is often championing new episodes. Phil Harbottle is producing. So he comes in right at the end to sort of just shepherd the book through production and to get it into the state we see it today.
Yeah, and also the editor, I think, Stephen James Walker, as well. Is that right? He works for Telos.
Yes, the publisher, yeah.
Yeah, but his friend Philip Harbottle comes in. John Lawrence had finished the text, but as you say, the final thing was not finished.
Not there.
And this comes out 2025, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So it's a lovely tribute to John Lawrence as well. Obviously, it's full of wonderful Ron Turner stories and artwork. Several sad losses, really. Ron Turner, Barry Tomlinson, John Lawrence himself.
Yeah.
As you say, just like to produce a book that is so immense and a sort of love letter to that techno-utopianism artwork, and then not to see it make, you know, publishing.
Yeah.
Published yourself is very sad.
Yeah.
Right, we're getting close to Grail Pages, but before we do that, did you have anything else you wanted to say about Ron?
No. I appreciate it's an expensive, large hardback book. You know, if you can't track this down, or it's, you know, not within your budget, then, you know, the Daleks special from Marvel UK. I think the original version was sort of came out in the early 80s, and then it got republished in the early 2020s. You know, I would track that down as introduction. I mean, it's a sort of high watermark of his work, but yeah, it's a fantastic tribute to that. So track that down, if not this whole book.
So this one, the hardback, is now shown as out of print, but secondhand copies somewhere between £40 and £100. I think it was a £50 book, wasn't it?
£50 book, I think, start with. So.
Amazon is listing a paperback version for £40, I think.
Right.
What, at time of recording? I don't know, £50.
Yeah.
But I don't know I haven't seen a paperback version.
No, I haven't seen it either. But I think again, I'm not sure if on the Telos website if they have the paperback version.
Right. I'll put some links in the show notes to Telos Publishing, and where you might be able to track down The Fantastic Art of Ron Turner by John Lawrence. A wonderful book about some wonderful art and a very interesting man. Let's play a reasonably expensive round of the Grail Page game.
Yeah.
We'll perhaps tell a quick story about that in a moment. But let's start off. Let's do this. So from the art that's reproduced in this book, what have you chosen?
There is so much art in here. I mean, I know normally, you know, you'd be looking at sort of a series that run in the Prog or the Mail, or saying, you know, they'll be like, oh, this is 15, 16, you know, there's a lot to choose from. But my God, there is a lot to choose from in here, you know, down to a top one is quite hard. So I will just give a couple of honorable mentions first, before I go into my choices. So there's a Dan Dare double page spread, on page 229. I encourage everyone to look at home. That's you know, I remember that very vividly, reading that as a child, an enormous creature. I think they're particularly scathing in the book about the quality of the story, but I'm not talking about the quality of the story. I'm talking about the quality of the art on this podcast. So there's that. There are some space babes on page 232 that I didn't choose, but could have done, and many people are here for the space babes.
Well, I mean, a piece of artwork that's got a robot and a space princess. We're always there.
We're always there.
Yeah.
The dinosaur on page 231 is particularly charming. I'd happily have a dinosaur staring down at me from the wall. But in the end, I did actually have to look at his Dalek artwork. And on page 298, you know, they are just so spectacular, the Dalek pages. This is double page spread. It's used as a cover, and it's just, I'm not sure with the Daleks you can consider it a techno-utopianism, but, you know, the sort of, as far as the Daleks are concerned, they would probably consider it utopianism. But I think they're fighting the multi-headed monsters, and you know, even the Daleks are having a tough day. His Dalek artwork is amazing, so it had to be a Dalek page for me in the end.
How about you?
Well, before we do that, let's just say the Dalek Chronicles from Marvel UK 1994, Ron Turner's wraparound cover. It shows Daleks, shows the Emperor Dalek, shows Dalek on the flying platform, shows this multi-headed Hydra beast. It shows a sort of jetpack-wearing robot, a couple of arguing aliens. It's got everything in there.
So, what more could you want?
I believe that was the 1994 compilation of the Dalek stories that for years or for decades was extremely hard to get hold of.
And expensive to when you could find it at all.
Yes. Very expensive on eBay, that was.
Yeah. So the reprint a few years ago has presumably taken all of the value out of all of that.
And that is a glorious piece of Ron Turner art. It's a wraparound cover, so it's a big piece of art, and it's got everything you want about him on there. So yes, I will show that in the various socials after this episode comes out. Also, a couple of pages earlier, 294, you just wanted to mention, you thought you ought to mention paperback covers.
I mean, this is where he comes into people's consciousness, and that sort of, I mean, you know, Steve Hollander's written extensively on sort of on the Mushroom Publishers or the Jungle Publishers, sort of this sort of independent publishing boom that occurs in the Second World War, and sci-fi is a big part of that. But yeah, there's an image on the top left on page 294 for a Vargo Staten SF magazine number one. It feels like a bit of a cheat because the image is sort of split into four. But if you do that, then you can have a space hero, a space babe, rockets, robots, weird creatures, a laser gun, amazing color. So, yeah.
And Vargo Staten, if I remember rightly, is like a made up name.
Are you sure? It sounds so authentic.
Yeah, it sounds authentic. Yeah. Was he the hero of the novels, or was he supposedly the writer of these pulp science fiction novels? Yes. I can't remember.
I'm not sure, but no, you're entirely right. It's a made up name, and you know, people are cranking this stuff out, you know, in tiny garrets, are sort of a penny a word, you know, publishing stuff of very short notice. So yeah.
So he's got recreations of four of his classic covers, and I'll post that page as well. And yeah, fantastic. I'm going to have to pick a Daleks page.
Obviously.
Now, I'm going to tell us a quick side quest, because on Friday, you and I went to Heathrow and picked up Conrad from the airport. And then you had a little diversion for us. Tell us where you took us on Friday morning.
So on Friday morning, knowing that, you can't check into a hotel till 3 o'clock, you know, there's no point dashing straight from Heathrow to Bristol. I thought, we could just have a slight side quest. So we went to King's Langley in Hertfordshire, which has got an enormous old Ovaltine factory in it, which was particularly spectacular. But that wasn't the reason we went. That would have been reason enough, but it wasn't the reason we went. We went to Excalibur Auctions, who are based there on a small industrial estate in King's Langley. And they were, yesterday as we record this on Saturday the 9th of May, were auctioning off the second part of the Peter Hanson collection. First part auctioned off earlier this year for Hanson Garland in Newcastle, for the second part auctioned off down here in Hertfordshire. So we went in a sort of, I wasn't quite, you know, had never been there before, I didn't quite know what we would get to see. You know, we'd be able to see some of the lots if we asked them. We'd be able to see all the lots. And it was about 400 lots in total, and some of them are individual items, but some of them are, you know,
bundles of comics.
Bundles of comics or bundles of annuals. Some of them are bundles of artwork, you know, from Peter's amazing collection. And yeah, we saw some pieces there that there was a Brian Bolland from Camelot 3000. It was a busy page that I didn't look at because I thought it was just a print.
Right.
And I thought, that's just a print. I won't even ask the guy to bring that over. It turned out to be an original piece of art that sold for £28,000.
£28,000, Simon Bisley. Yeah, okay.
So I slightly regret that. But we did see, there was some Ron Turner artwork there. So we saw some, I think, some Battle Action, so probably the Spinball Slaves.
Yes.
So we saw that. There was a David Lloyd piece from V for Vendetta. There was Don Lawrence work. There was a W.D. Watkins page that I looked at. It was, incredible selections. And, you know, I don't think he was expecting any other visitors. So, you know, he's quite pleased to see us, quite amenable, quite chatty.
Let's took the art out. Let's look at the art.
Yeah. Ian Kennedy Page.
Yeah. It went for quite good money as well.
£100. So, it was fantastic. And they had a Ron Turner Dalek page.
So we had in our sweaty hands a Ron Turner Dalek page, which is reproduced on page 151 of this book. And we talked to the guy about what price it was going to go for. And I put in a speculative bid on it. So I did actually bid on this page.
Yeah.
It is going to be my Grail page. I will reprint it. I will say that it sold yesterday for £2,800, not to me.
Okay. Just for the record, for the benefit of the tape.
Not to me. So it's still my Grail page. But yes, a Ron Turner Dalek page sold yesterday at auction for £2,800. And we had literally been holding that page in our hands the day before.
Yeah. At least we know it exists. You know, often with the Grail page, we think, I wonder what happened to this. But well, this page, we don't know who owns it. You know, somebody has spent their money very wisely on that and all power to their elbow. But at least we know it exists. And we could find it.
I also bid on some Judge Dredd pages and didn't win those either. And you bid on some other lots, and I don't think you were terribly successful either.
No, I wasn't. No, I put in some lowball offers for some things, and was not surprised that I was outbid on things. But yeah, the Peter Hanson collection is vast. I think there are more auctions to come.
Yes, at least two more.
So you know there will be more things that are creeping out of the woodwork that, in time, you know, may surface again in other places. So it's just lovely to see.
I think I'm right in saying we both did buy something from the first auction, which was from a different auction house.
Yes.
But we both were successful on that auction.
We were, yeah.
Slightly more obscure, unusual, and therefore cheaper pages, I think, which will be the subject possibly of a future Comic Lunch Club.
Yes.
Okay. But yeah, we didn't get the Ron Turner page, but I will show it. I will put a link to Excalibur Auctions in the show notes. They're very friendly and accommodating. Mm-hmm. And let us clamber over books, comics, and original artwork. Yeah,
they were delightful.
Okay, so those are the Grail pages. I'm going to post several of yours and that one of mine. Fascinating. Now, we've mentioned how you can get hold of the book. I mean, highly recommend it, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, another classic post-war comic book science artist. The Ovaltine building we saw yesterday. Yes. Hint of techno-utopianism about that as well, that, you know, the future's going to be bright.
Yeah, it was big. It was big, yeah. You know, it was,
Here we are living in the future. It's not quite as bright as we hoped it was going to be. Okay. So, Ron Turner artwork does turn up in these auctions.
Yeah.
I've seen a fair bit of it recently.
Yeah, Compal have had some. There was a sort of a short story from Eagle, from the New Eagle, a sort of one-off four pages. That turned up that sold for about £250. I didn't win that, but it does turn up, and certainly I think, you know, part of the volume of work that he produced, you know, in the sort of this, the final arc of his career, you know, some of that is definitely turning up on places like comic book postal auctions. So we've seen them there. So it is, you know, it is possible. Maybe the strip work is harder to get hold of than the cover recreations, but the cover recreations are definitely out there.
And the cover recreations are beautiful, gorgeous.
Yes.
Yeah. If only we'd got the future that it predicted. Oh, well, never mind. I keep saying that. Never mind.
Have you read that? There's a Tom Gould book of cartoons, isn't there? We were promised jetpacks.
Yes.
And I feel that is, yes, I should be banging my finger on the table at this point saying, we were promised jetpacks. What happened to them? Where are they? Well, I've been diddled. So,
yeah. I was talking on a Star Trek podcast recently about the Carl Urban Dread film and just very quickly making the point that we had Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek utopianism. Future's going to be like this. Then by the 90s, a Stallone film, the future is going to be flying cars, but it's going to be horrible. And then by 2012, the future's just going to be like it is presently, just worse.
We appear to be living in the grim dark.
Yes, we are in this. Grim dark has reached us as opposed to techno-utopianism. Yeah. Right. Thank you, Richard. We've got a fair bit to talk about. I perhaps should mention this is unusually, this book, I don't think features your name at all. You weren't consulted on this one.
No. I would have pointed out they spell Stephen Mouse's name wrong throughout it. Sadly.
Right.
I mean, I say throughout, it makes it sound like he's in every page, but he's not. But, you know, there's...
However, you do continue to fact check for Battling Britons and some Book Palace stuff.
Yeah, so Illustrators magazine for the Book Palace comes out quarterly, and they also produce a number of specials. So I work on those. Always very interesting sort of comic artists from around the world. I think issue 50 has just come up. I mean, I got Glenn Fabry to sign a copy of issue 41, where he is the subject of the cover art. Greg Staples is downstairs. Again, he's been the subject of a lengthy article in Illustrators. Signed my copy of that last year. So yes, an interesting mix of artists that we would know from the present day, artists from the past, US artists. Yeah, there's an amazing array that the editor Diego finds to talk about. So, and I'm hopefully, well, I am going to write my first article for Illustrators, issue 54, 55, whenever it comes out. So, yes, I'm looking forward to doing that.
Oh, well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. Great. Yes. So,
you also did some fact-checking and proofing on James Bacon's Irish Conflict in Comics, which I recently read.
Yeah.
And I have passed on to our mutual friend Jamie Beamish, appropriately.
Yeah. And, yeah, James continues to write about comics. He's been working very hard recently, and he's been in the... He's got another book coming out this summer. So he's been deep in the depths of libraries and archives this week, sending me snippets of things. And I think it's, you know, the cultural context in which comics have been published in Ireland, you know, is particularly interesting / challenging. So I think it will be another really interesting read.
Right. Excellent. Well, look forward to it. And hopefully I will be able to get James to come on the pod. We keep asking him. But anyway, we'll see. Obviously, boysadventurecomics.blogspot.com continues. It's now got over... When's its next big number?
Well, I think when this comes out, it'll be about post 3,650. So another year till we get to a big number.
Right.
4,000.
4,000.
So, yeah. But no, it continues to come out every day. I still find things that I'm interested enough to want to log or document or talk about, or you know, consult the sort of Facebook or internet hive mind to say, I don't know very much about this, but I bet somebody out there does or can help with a piece of the jigsaw. I particularly love those ones where it's like we start, like I say, with one piece of the jigsaw, you know, and it might take 6 months, it might take a year, it might take the right person to go, oh, I can do that. You know, there's one person out there who knows everything about that, but you know, you have to find that person to then have them say, okay, here's all the rest of the pieces of the puzzle, look at it now. And you go, oh, okay. So, yeah, no, I was pleased to meet some 2008 forum people last night. Colin YNWA and a couple of his friends at the bar, and they said very nice things. And that was very,
So
it continues.
It continues. Yes. Excellent. Right. We've got a story coming up about another British comic book artist and an acquisition of yours. But just quickly say, Lawless is downstairs, and you've mentioned some of the artists who are here. Just say a word or two about Liam Sharp, who's sort of guest of honour and got the exhibit, and tell us about your Grail page that you picked.
Yep, so Liam Sharp is downstairs. I think he's sort of celebrating 40 years in the comic book business this year. And I think his plan I heard him talking to somebody about this, was to say, oh, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring, you know, 40 pieces of art, you know, one from every year of my, you know, sort of really see how it is. And then he realized that he hasn't got enough room in the car.
Right.
For 40 pages of framed artwork, you know, no car is big enough, or, you know, no back axle is strong enough to cope with that sort of weight. But he has got an amazing array of art downstairs, original art downstairs for us to enjoy and to look at. And he's, you know, he's happily signing sketches, doing quick sketches,
yes,
as he calls it. So he did a quick sketch for me yesterday, a Doom Lord sketch that I'm particularly pleased with. I had an old comic fanzine that I gave him that he'd done the cover for in about 2012. I said, oh, I bet nobody's asked you to sign this today. And he was like, oh, I haven't seen this for a very long time. And I was like, oh, let's see. That's your first Doom Lord piece. What about another one? So, yeah, so he did that. So, yeah, there is an amazing array of barbarians. And is barbarians and babes? Is that a genre?
Yeah.
You know, he's king of the Conan art. So there are a number of lovely Conan pieces, you know, rippling torsos, the veins popping out on everyone's torsos that, you know, are astonishing to look at. But there was one piece that I would particularly... I mean, none of this artwork has a label or a title, or I don't know where it fits into any of the publication history.
I'm just going to have to post the pictures.
But yeah, yes. You'll post the picture and say, it's this picture he means. But yes, it was one picture that is made sort of a forest scene, which is all in black ink, and then about a third of the way across the page is then this sort of nymph or naiad or dryad or, you know, I'm not sure the right word would be, figurine in there as well. But just the woodland scene is astonishing. The amount of detail, you know, it's just it's incredible. The sort of every leaf,
yes,
you know, every vine, every blade of grass, you know, has been, I don't know how fine a pen nib you would have to use, but it's the level of detail is incredible. And it's just it was just astonishing. For sort of there's no effort skimped on that phase at all. So it's just beautiful sort of, maybe a more relaxing scene than his normal sort of Conan dripping blood or dripping sweat. Or, I mean, there's one page in there which is rather like your favourite piece of comic art, which is the, is it John Byrne on that sort of pile of, which is the one I'm thinking of.
Gosh, who did that piece? Heroes, Spartans?
Oh, no, I'm not thinking of that.
Oh, you're thinking, no, Barry Windsor Smith.
And
the Wolverine, the Conan page, Windsor Smith's Conan page, yes.
Yes, there's one which I felt was quite reminiscent of that. But yeah, this beautiful woodland carving scene by Liam Sharp. It's just, you know, I dread to think, you know, sort of, I would look at it and think, oh, it's probably taken you about 6 months, that page, and it's probably, if you asked him, he'd probably say, oh, several days, and oh my god, yeah, but there is a craft and a detail in there which is amazing. So yeah, so woodland scene by Liam. But yeah, it was hard to choose from.
I'm going to try and do a little gallery of the various Grail pages we've chosen, so I'll link to it in the show notes hopefully. I just find it fascinating, that early progression from his Bisley clone is perhaps unfair to Liam Sharp, but those early exaggerated muscular men and babes, as it were. You know.
There's definitely a couple of pieces like that downstairs, yes, that are very of their time, shall we say.
And now this incredibly detailed Starhenge, Conan the Barbarian, this black and white pen strokes, so many, as you say, every leaf, every root, every bit of flesh, everything. It's amazing.
Yeah,
just astonishing work.
So, no, it was great. It was an excellent idea. Him and Sue came up with this as a plan, so I like it very much.
Great stuff. Now, you are a proud member of the Comic Art Luncheon Club.
Indeed.
A small group of us who meet up regularly in London and share and discuss artwork and stories.
Very true.
You're the unofficial treasurer, a job title that comes with no responsibilities or duties or remuneration, because I've been giving out job titles for some time, imaginary job titles for some time. At a recent meeting, you told us a story about an acquisition. Mm-hmm. And I want you to tell at least part of that story, because obviously we can't have the visuals, but the story of what you acquired and what it is. Tell us about that. Tell us about the British artist, Eric Parker.
So Eric Parker was not, and again, we won't, but we could dedicate, a lot of time, or I could dedicate a lot of time to talk about Eric Parker. Born at the end of the 19th century, lives till 1974, and works, so 75, 76 when he dies, and seems to spend almost all of that time producing comic art for all the companies that eventually we would think of as Spleetway, IPC, and so he's an astonishing sort of longevity of a career. I suppose most famously, and the what I knew him most for, were his covers for sort of Sexton Blake libraries. So they're not picture libraries; they're sort of text stories, but they're in the same sort of size as a Commando Digest, shall we say? And he does these fantastic sort of. I think he starts on in the late 20s, early 30s, and they're, very evocative. And I always thought. Oh, those are great, and again, he produced a lot of them over, a long period of time, and he thought, oh, they're sort of £250 each, and he said, oh, he's trying to get one piece of art for £250. Yeah, that's £250. That's and then one morning, I was just like, oh, there's a lot here, which is described as Eric Parker over 100 sketches, and you think, oh, and you say, oh, it's about the same price. Oh, actually, that's an astonishing value per sketch. That's 250. Okay. Oh, okay. I'll be very brave. Press the buy now button. Press the buy now button. Thank you very much. eBay wheels start churning. And then a short time later, a few days later, I think it was one of my neighbors that had to take in the parcel because we weren't in. And this package, sort of the size of a small coffin, is delivered to me. So I was quite surprised. About, I didn't think that over 100 sketches would need a parcel quite so big. And when I eventually worked my way through this parcel, I discovered that 100 sketch, 100 pieces of art was not really what was on offer. What was really on offer was about 300 pieces of art. And some of them are very small, sort of scraps of paper, almost sort of, inch squares or postage stamp size. Most of them are very big, A3, sort of holiday paintings almost. But the sort of the range of material. I mean, Parker, like I'm sure, like a lot of the artists downstairs, just draws all the time, and just the amount of paper you would just get through, and you would produce the quantity is astonishing. But this lot. Seems to cover like across the whole range of his career. I mean, it's in no way an archive of all that he produced because, 50 years of working, and producing stuff every single week for the Fleetway and its, progenitors would give you an enormous quantity of work. So this is, 300 pages or 300 pieces is a drop in the ocean, but it does beautifully cover, I feel. It feels like, his long career and has very sort of personal items, sort of Christmas cards, back, from the sort of mid-50s, early 60s, back to sort of really early work, the usual sort of advertising material that really doesn't look like, it's a more distinctive style. Only some of it is signed, but it's all very distinctly his. And there are definitely some sketches in there that's a very Sexton Blake image or those headshots that you've been practicing will definitely end up in a Sexton Blake cover somewhere along the way. And, he was so prolific, you could spend a very long time trying to work out where all these sketches actually landed, but you would have so many titles to go through and so much art, it's more than I can bear to do. But
it would need a John Lawrence sized endeavor to do it, wouldn't it? Yeah.
Indeed. So instead, I've ended up with sort of housing it, more professionally, taking it out of this enormous cardboard box that it arrived in into sort of four very large A3 folders, and slowly, slowly blogging about all the art. And we will eventually get to the end, and I will have shared all of the art that I purchased in this one big job lot of Eric Parker artwork. So plenty of posts so far, plenty more to come.
Search for Eric Parker on boysadventurecomics.blogspot.com because you're slowly, as you say, cataloguing it all. Obviously, when a well-known artist passes away, we think about their studio and what's in their studio. Tony Esmond and I went to see Carl Giles's archive at the University of Kent in Canterbury, We were talking about, you know, people like Gerald Scarfe and Ralph Steadman recently. What happens to their archives? In a way, it feels like possibly the family have just cleared out Eric Parker's portfolio of bits and pieces he had in his studio and just put it up as a job lot.
Yeah.
And now you have got it.
Now I've got it, yeah. And I'm ready. Like I say, because it's over such a long time period, it's very, you know, you would sort of think if it was, it's not just, oh, this is what I was producing last week and it's only what I was producing last week. It's actually over a much, you know, 50, 60 year time span, it feels like. And yeah, with the sort of, you know, it's such a, an array of material, sort of, you know, there are life studies, there are, you know, like I say, his early advertising work, Christmas cards, you know, letters that he's sending out to people, sort of, you know, that he's receiving back from people, paintings from his holidays, where, you know, which look like, which some of them I think are sort of southern Spain and Portugal, you know, probably in a time when getting to southern Spain and Portugal was A, quite hard, and B, quite expensive. So actually the fact that he could go there at all meant that, you know, he was well remunerated enough in his work to be able to go off to, you know, the Mediterranean for his holiday in a way that, you know, all his compatriots, you know, were not going to the Mediterranean, you know, in the 30s and 40s and 50s. So yeah, it's a very different world. So,
and you bought a small selection of the art to show us in London, and it was just an extraordinary, you know, I felt privileged to see it, and I felt privileged to hear the story, which you've now shared with the Megacity Book Club. That's extraordinary. You are the expert at what I would describe as finding slightly obscure lots on auctions, which are just fascinating, and tell us something about British comic book and British illustration and so on. For the listeners, I would just say, I don't know Richard's secret, but he is across a lot of auctions. It seems you watch a lot of auctions.
I delete a lot of emails for a lot of people to find that stuff. But you're right, that's, you know, you sift through enough, you pan through enough stuff, you know, you find those flecks of gold at the bottom, metaphorically. So yeah, well worth doing.
And all of this, and all those 3,500 blogs and everything, and fact-checking, proofreading people's books and magazines, and you got a full-time job and a family as well.
That's what I mean.
I don't know how you do it, Richard. I really don't know how you do it. Yeah. Well, extraordinary. Thank you so much. Fantastic book. Some fantastic stories. We'll go off now downstairs for Lawless Day 2 and see how we get on. And who knows where we'll be in a year, whether we'll be at a 50th or at Lawless or wherever. But hopefully we'll be back to talk about some more great British artists.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thank you. Thank you.
And thank you to everyone for listening to the Book Club. As ever, megacitybookclub.com to see the links to Excalibur Auctions and to a gallery of some of the pages we've been talking about. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, Blue Sky, Mastodon, Substack, the 2080 forums, and on the 2080 subreddit. And email me, mcbcpodcast@gmail.com. If you've got a book, a creator, a story, anything you'd like to come on and talk about. So from here in Bristol, until next time, it's goodbye from me and...
It's goodbye from me. Right.